Hi, I'm Carmen LaBerge. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Hello, friends. Welcome to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. Thank you so much for joining me here today. I think in today's opening segment, I think we have to all recognize the big headline today is the Senate confirmation hearing of Judge Brett Kavanaugh, now underway in Washington, D.C. Brett Kavanaugh is President Trump's nominee to the U.S. Supreme Court following the retirement of Justice Kennedy. So we're going to actually deal with that subject at length in the connecting point, which is in the final segment of today's show, because I want to really give it appropriate time and attention today. And we will probably circle back around to the Judge Kavanaugh confirmation process many times this week because of its significance for our common life and the opportunities that it gives us as Christians for conversations in the culture today. If you want, if you missed my conversation with Ken Starr here on Connecting Faith, you could go to myfaithradio.com to the Connecting Faith page and find that show. He was on with me on the 24th. Of August. So you're looking for the August 24th show, and Ken Starr was my guest. And Ken Starr was for a period of time Brett Kavanaugh's boss, and so he had some personal insights and obviously some insights from their time together investigating former President Clinton. So anyway, it was an interesting conversation with Ken Starr. I encourage you to go check that out. I want to lift up a half a dozen headlines this morning under what I call the Pray the News. I just call it hashtag Pray the News. So there are things that happen in the world that you and I really have a difficult time imagining we have any influence over, any way to engage, any way to let people know that they're loved and not forgotten, to somehow bring God's power to bear. Well, we can do that. We just have to pray. And so I'm going to encourage us today to pray the news on several fronts. First of all, we have neighbors here in the United States of America bracing for a hurricane. And these are folks who on the Mississippi and Louisiana and Alabama Gulf Coast who have a lot of experience with hurricanes. But every time it happens, there are those who think that they don't need to evacuate. They don't need to prepare. And so that puts first responders in dire situations as then those people try to evacuate after it's really too late to get out. And so let me just go ahead and encourage us to be praying the news that anyone who is able to evacuate will go ahead and do so. And those who want to evacuate but think they are unable, let's encourage those folks to go ahead and reach out and get the help that they need to evacuate now. So that would be my pray the news here on the home front. But around the world, we have several Pray the News items. You heard one of those, or actually a couple of those, lifted up at the headline news at the top of the hour. We certainly need to be praying for the millions of people in Idlib province in Syria. The Idlib province is the place to which millions of people fled when their own communities, when their own towns were overrun during this very protracted Syrian civil war. And so many of the people in Idlib province are already like internally displaced people within the country of Syria. And so it's not as if they are in hardened shelters. It's not as if they have a lot of adequate resources where they could hunker down and wait out these aerial attacks, these aerial bombing attacks that the Russians are now just letting loose on these people. And I recognize that it's a really complex situation, but let you and I be praying that innocent life would be preserved, that God would place a hedge of protection, around people who are already in fear for their lives and have already fled once for their lives from their own communities, overrun either by ISIS or overrun during the Syrian civil war conflict between the rebels and the Assad government. We certainly also want to be praying today for our Christian brothers and sisters in Egypt. The Coptic Christians in Egypt are experiencing renewed and severe persecution. There was a failed, thanks be to God, failed attack on our embassy in Cairo. And we just want to really be lifting up people who are in just really in the crossfire of ongoing unrest in the Middle East. And it is sectarian, but it's also religious. And I just think we need to keep that in mind. The religious freedom that we enjoy here is not enjoyed by people around the world. Let's lift up in that same spirit in our Pray the News section, our conversation here today. Let's be praying for our brothers and sisters in China. I want you to imagine for a moment. I mean, here in America, like, I don't know what happens at your house on Sunday morning, but there might be days, there might be Sunday mornings where it feels like you got to force your kids to go to church. In China, children are forbidden to go to church. They're forbidden from going to church. Well, if your children are forbidden from going to church, in order to be a good parent, you're going to have to stay home with them as well. And so this is an effort by the Chinese government to stifle the church. Well, you and I both know that that just turns homes into churches. And so let us be praying that God would turn those Christian families into home churches, that those homes, that their households of faith would actually be expressions of the larger household of faith, that God would figure out ways to allow those Christian believers in China to be able to gather, to continue to grow in their faith, and that maybe through media, I don't really know, maybe through ways in which only God knows, that not only would they have access to the Word of God, but they would have access to people who can disciple them. And so that would be my encouragement on that front. And then finally, I don't know if you're familiar with what's happening in Myanmar, but there are several journalists who have now been convicted of some pretty serious crimes. And so, you know, what we're talking about there is a lack of freedom of speech, a lack of the freedom of the press. And so even in this nation where sometimes we get frustrated by things that are said so freely that we disagree with, or things that are said by the media or ideas that are broadcast that we don't agree with, hey, I just want us to be ever thankful that we live in a country where we enjoy these absolute guaranteed freedoms of speech, freedom of religion, freedom to assemble, and freedom to protest, right? So all of those things are not freedoms enjoyed by people in China, Myanmar, Egypt, Syria. We could go on down the list. So I want to be praying the news today. There's one story that we've been following the progress of in California, and I have an important update on California Bill AB 2943. And you're saying to yourself, okay, I have slept, Carmen, since the last time you talked about California Bill AB 2943. So you're going to have to remind me, what is that all about? Well, that is the so-called conversion therapy bill. We talked at length about this subject with Tyler O'Neill from PJ Media here on the show on the 20th of August, if you want to go back and listen to that full conversation that we had. But essentially, the California Bill AB 2943 was designed to make it a fraudulent business practice in the state of under the state of California's consumer protection law. It would make it illegal for anyone to be paid in any way, shape or form for teaching or counseling someone who was seeking to change their sexual identity or their same-sex attraction. So Assemblyman Evan Lowe is the person who put forth this piece of legislation. He's an openly gay man. He has now withdrawn his effort. Now, I would say it's probably he's hit the pause button. And the reason that he cites is there was so much pushback. There was so much advocacy by Christians in California that that he pulled the bill from consideration by the California Assembly. And he's getting a lot of blowback now from LGBTQ advocates. So no one expects this to be the end of the debate. Lowe is certainly experiencing the hard left pressing in. They are unsatisfied with the reasons that he has given. And so while it's good news for Christians who are concerned about freedom of speech and churches concerned about, you know, the ability to sell in their church bookstores, churches or books that contain information about what the Bible actually says about gender, about sex, about sexual relationships, about marriage. But I think we also have to recognize, and if you read the coverage of this, you're going to recognize there's a lot of pain on the other side of this conversation. So I just want to encourage folks today, when you're talking with folks, about this. Let's not be, let's not be, this is really not cause for celebration. This is cause for, this is certainly a relief, but this is not really a time for Christian cultural celebration. This is, I think, a time for Christians to lean in and start walking with those people who are hurting and disillusioned and lacking hope and genuinely confused. And so I'm wondering if we could, in the spirit of the resurrected Christ, right, we are actually empowered by the spirit of the one who is risen from the dead. And so couldn't we walk with people who are in grief today? I'm thinking here about the walk to Emmaus that Jesus took after his resurrection. You know, he came alongside two disciples who were leaving Jerusalem believing that Jesus had been crucified and their hopes dashed. And they thought he was the Messiah, but now he was dead. And over the course of a long journey at a fairly slow pace, because when you're walking in grief, you're generally walking at a slow pace. And it was over that course of time that Jesus heard their concerns. And then he began to slowly open to them the scriptures and how he was revealed in them. And by the time they got to Emmaus, these guys were already changed. And then they sat down at table fellowship with Jesus. And what happened? Christ was made known to them in the breaking of the bread. So I'm wondering if, as Christians today who are walking alongside people in the LGBTQ community who are disappointed today at the fact that California Bill AB 2943 has been pulled, because they really were hoping that that would be sort of a watershed moment for the country in terms of legislation. Is it possible that we could walk with them today in their disillusionment and that we could slowly but surely open the word to them in such a way that they could actually see the transforming power of God that's available to them? And maybe even Christ would be made known to them when we break bread and table fellowship. So that's I hope, a little inspiration for today. Hey, I got to take a quick break. When I come back, I'm going to be joined by Stephen Grisevich. You know him. We have talked with him before about Key Ministries and all that they're doing in relationship to equipping the church to welcome and minister alongside families whose kids have mental disorders. And so Stephen will be here right when we get back. I am Carmen LaBerge. You're listening to Connecting Faith. Hey friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm Carmen LaBerge, thrilled to be joined today by Dr. Stephen Grisevich. He works with an organization called Key Ministry. Key Ministry promotes meaningful connection between churches and families of kids with disabilities for the purpose of making disciples of Jesus Christ. Stephen, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Carmen, thanks for having me back.
So I'm tempted to ask you about this special report that Key Ministry just released on Twitter, which folks can follow them at Key Ministry, Mental Health Within Our School Systems. But what you're really on today is to talk about this piece you have posted on the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission website, and the article's entitled, Who's Missing from Children and Student Ministries? So I won't be greedy and ask about schools. I'll instead stay focused on the church.
Well, thanks for doing that. Thanks for calling attention to a really important study. So Andrew Whitehead is a sociologist at Clemson University. He's also the father of two sons with autism. And he published a paper about a month ago in the Journal of the Scientific Study of Religion, looking specifically at the extent to which different disabilities in kids increase the likelihood that those children and then presumably their families will never attend church. And what he found was really interesting in that essentially it's the hidden disabilities that keep kids out of church. When you go back and look at some of the statistics that they came up with in the study, that they found that, again, that there wasn't a statistically significant difference in kids with Tourette's syndrome, kids with epilepsy, kids with hearing problems, kids with vision problems being able to attend church. But it was the hidden disabilities. It's kids with autism spectrum disorders and kids with common mental health conditions who are the ones who appear most likely to be excluded from church.
So let me read some of the things on that list. These are the kids who are likely to be excluded from church. Kids with autism, depression, traumatic brain injury, oppositional defiant disorder, anxiety, speech problems, learning disabilities, and ADD, ADHD. I got to tell you that I'm a stepmom to two kids who are in those categories, and it is a real challenge.
Well, and part of the problem is, and why this is such an issue for the church, is that, you know, now that we're looking at like one in five kids who have a significant mental health condition, not only does one in five kids at risk of not being part of church, but they have brothers and sisters, they have parents, they have extended families. And when the child has a condition that makes it difficult for the family to attend church, we end up missing out on the opportunity to share the gospel with everybody else in the family at the same time. And we miss out on the gifts and talents that those kids and their families have to contribute to the church.
So you have this paragraph in here. And again, friends, my guest is Dr. Stephen Grisevich. You can follow what we're talking about on Twitter at Key Ministry. You include this paragraph. One in 59 school-aged children in the U.S. Have been diagnosed with autism. One in every five youth meet criteria for a mental health disorder associated with severe role impairment and or distress, including 11% with mood disorders, 8% with anxiety disorders, and 10% with behavioral disorders. So if we're looking across the kids and young people, students that are in our churches, and we're not seeing those levels of challenge, then what should that tell us?
Well, it tells us that we have an awful lot of kids and families who are missing from the church, who God intended to be there, but there are either issues with sort of our understanding in terms of how to minister most effectively with them, or issues that they're struggling with where there are barriers in terms of them being able to enter into the environments in which we do ministry, and their ability to enter into the culture of the church becomes more of a challenge because of them having these conditions.
So you have some ideas for churches, because I think that we don't do anything because we feel like we have to do everything. We feel like we got to launch a big program. Give us some ideas of what we can do to just get started.
Okay, I think that the most important idea here is that just do something. You know, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. And so no church is going to be able to welcome perfectly every child and every family impacted by one of these hidden disabilities. But every church can do more to welcome more families where they're at right now. So here are four specific ideas. The first thing I would encourage churches to do is to identify specific resources to be able to train your staff and to be able to begin to develop a specific plan for welcoming and including, you know, kids with mental health conditions, you know, kids, you know, on the high end of the autism spectrum and their families. So our ministry's developed a whole model for doing this that we talked about with you before. And so we have an entire series of free video trainings available on our website. And we're also available to consult free of charge to churches that are looking to welcome, you know, kids with disabilities and their families. CLC Network is another ministry that does wonderful work in terms of training and supporting not just churches but Christian schools to be able to include persons of all abilities. So one is to go ahead and get trained. Two,
okay.
If I would encourage you.
Okay. So let's give people those two websites before we move on to the next point. So it's keyministry.org,
yes.
keyministry.org,
.org.
And the CLC network is just clcnetwork.org. All right, now take us to the second idea.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Second idea is I'd encourage churches to think about starting a respite outreach. Because when kids have a developmental disability or significant mental health condition, it poses a huge burden on marriages. And a lot of our missing kids are being raised by single parents who may lack the support or the financial resources to be able to access high-quality child care. So that by launching a respite outreach and by including, quote-unquote, typical siblings in your respite outreach, it's a great way of being able to develop relationships with families in your community who aren't connected with a church. By serving the typical siblings, you decrease any resistance that you would encounter among kids with common mental health conditions who would feel like they're being included in programming for kids with special needs. And so there are two outstanding ministries that we work with that have nationwide networks of churches that are doing respite care. One is Nathaniel's Hope, and their respite network is referred to as Buddy Break. And then the other is 99 Balloons. And so both of them provide ongoing training and support to churches that are interested in using respite care as a way of welcoming families in their communities who are excluded as a result of disability.
All right, and you've got a couple of other ideas for us as well. You say we got to start talking about it.
Well, one of the biggest issues, there was a large study that was done several years ago by the folks at Lifeway and Focus on the Family. And what they found is that families that were affected by mental illness, what they most wanted was to hear the topic discussed from the pulpit. So talk about this in your sermons. Consider hosting a speaker to talk about some of the challenges that parents might experience in managing kids and coming to church when they have kids with these types of hidden disabilities. Use your social media platform in your church to be able to educate your attendees about mental illness and autism and make it very easy for them to be able to share those resources with their friends and neighbors. Because one of the things that was found from like the Lifeway study was that the majority of adults who don't attend church are of the belief that churches won't welcome persons with mental illness. And so that one of the things that we have to do is we have to give permission to people inside of the church to be able to talk about these issues and at the same time signal to folks outside of the church that if they do have a child with a mental health struggle that they're going to be welcomed. And then finally, one of the things I would encourage churches to think about doing is to launch a group specifically to support teens with mental illness. And there are two, again, outstanding ministries. The folks at Mental Health Grace Alliance have a wonderful new curriculum designed to help young people who are struggling with unhealthy patterns of thinking, struggling with anxiety, insecurity, and despair, to reconsider their assumptions in a scriptural context. And Fresh Hope for Teens is another small group model that is offered by a very reputable ministry out of Nebraska that has a nationwide network of Christian-based support groups, initially for adults, but also for teens with mental illness.
So, Dr. Grisevich, thank you so much. Friends, you can find this article at erlc.org, and you can actually, in that, find all of the links to all of the ministries that we have lifted up today, but you can go to keyministry.org to connect with Dr. Grisevich and all of the great things that they are doing to equip the church to engage with families who have children and students with these hidden disorders. So, Dr. Grisevich, thank you so much for joining us today on Connecting Faith.
And thank you, Carmen, for helping to get the word out to families that the church can be a welcoming place.
Absolutely. All right, friends, when we come back, I'm going to be talking with Jarrett Stevens about the call of the mountains. This is Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. We'll be right back.
I want to build a house up on this mountain, way up high where the peaceful waters flow.
Hey, friends, you're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. I am joined now by Pastor Jarrett Stevens. His book is The Mountains Are Calling. He's the teaching pastor at Prestonwood Baptist Church in Plano, Texas. Jarrett, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Carmen, thanks so much for having me today.
So I think like Peter on the Mount of Transfiguration, and like the song says, we want to build mountains up there where we have those mountaintop experiences. So let's talk about the way the mountains call to us. The title of the book is The Mountains Are Calling. You then say, I must go. Tell us why.
Well, you know, that quote, if anybody listening to us has been to the mountains a lot, there's a famous quote by a guy named John Muir who said, the mountains are calling. And he kind of made that quote famous, but they leave out that last part where he said, "And I must go." And the whole really goal of John Muir's life was to go up to the mountains, to travel, and then to write about what he experienced there. And so I kind of took that just in the opening chapter and kind of explained his life, but really took a spiritual spin to it to say, you know, the same is true for us. God gives us mountaintop experiences where we sense his nearness and his closeness to us, and there's spiritual markers in our life, and he gives those mountaintop moments to us so that we can come back down and tell people what we've experienced on the mountaintops of life with God.
So we have these spiritual mountaintop experiences, and we have this need to ascend the mountain, and you give us great equipping in the book. I love the climbing exercises for individuals and groups. I think that's really helpful. But tell us, as you walk through these mountaintop experiences in the Bible, tell us why you picked these mountains.
Yeah, well, you know, this started for me. I was flying into Colorado. I was speaking at a camp to some senior high students, and I grew up in the church, and so the mountaintop experience was kind of a term I was familiar with, and that's what camp was for me growing up. And so I'm flying into Colorado to preach to these students, and you know, I had something planned that I was going to preach, but I just felt like the Lord was saying go a different direction. And so I started thinking about it and praying about it, going, what can I do? I want camp to be a mountaintop experience. Here I am preaching in the mountains of Colorado. And that's when it just kind of hit me. The Spirit of the Lord just said, why don't you open up your Bibles and see what I did on the mountaintops? And I was just blown away, Carmen, by everything that I discovered. You know, I've been to Israel a number of times. It makes sense, of the mountains, just because Israel's such a mountainous terrain. But you think about some of the most epic stories that we know of in the Bible. I mean, Abraham going to Mount Moriah to sacrifice his son Isaac. Mount Carmel, where Elijah goes to battle the gods. Mount Sinai, where Moses gets the Ten Commandments. I mean, in the Old Testament, these stories are we all know them, they're familiar with them, we love them, and I found it to be a truth that when God wanted to do something special in the hearts of his people, when he was commanding something of a prophet, or wanted to show them, reveal to them kind of a new element of who he was, he would take them to the mountains. And you get to the New Testament, Carmen, it's the exact same thing with Jesus. You look at his life, his first sermon wasn't in a synagogue or the temple, it was on a mountainside. He was crucified on a mountain, he ascended from a mountain, his promised return is to the mountain. You talked about the transfiguration, introducing this segment. It all happened on a mountaintop. So it's amazing what God teaches us on the mountains.
Okay, so I love that. And as we walk through these, we could stop on any one of these mountains and have you like talk about how it is that we discover a particular character attribute of God. Because I actually like the way you have designed this. So on Mount Moriah, we discover the God who is provider. On Mount Sinai, we discover the God who is holy. Take us to Mount Desolate. I think that of the mountains in your book, Mount Desolate might be one that we need to visit.
Well, what I discovered in Jesus' life, like I said, so many of the major events of his life happened on a mountain. But when you study the Gospels, Luke's Gospel specifically tells us that Jesus would oftentimes break away to a desolate place and pray. And it even says a desolate mountain. And so that chapter is all about routine and the importance of developing a routine in our life, spending time alone with the Lord. I mean, if Jesus, the very Son of God, had to get alone and spend time with his Father, how much more important is it for us, sinful men and women, to get alone with God and to spend time with him? And here's the thing about the mountaintops. You know, we long for mountaintop experiences. We love those moments where God's nearness is close and his voice in our life seems so strong and our sense to follow him is strong in our life. We love those moments. But here's the truth, Carmen, and you know this, and those listening know this. God's Holy Spirit lives in us. And so figuratively speaking, we don't have to go to a literal mountaintop. Figuratively speaking, whenever we open up God's word and spend time alone with him, we're on the mountaintop. So, I mean, this morning, before I start my day, I'm opening up God's word and I'm praying to him. I'm on the mountaintop. And so that's what that chapter is all about. It's getting alone to a desolate place, to a lonely place where it's just you and the Lord and spending time with him.
So for anybody who's ever been to Plano, Texas, They pretty much know that now what you're talking about is not just physical ascent.
That's right.
There's no physical mountains in Plano, Texas, at least not any that I've ever seen.
So zero, yes.
Yeah, I appreciate that what you're helping us to gain is this perspective. And you talk about this change in perspective that happens. You talk about two truths. Tell us what those are.
Yeah, well, this became alive for me. I take my girls, our family travels out to the mountains just about every summer, and we'll go out to a certain place that has a ski gondola that goes up to the mountain, and we spend some time on the mountain, then we come back down. And when we're on our way back down the mountain, it's always fun. I'm riding there with my little girls, and they'll start picking out where we're staying and where we're going to eat ice cream later, where they want to eat ice cream later. And what's amazing is when you're on top of the ski lift coming down, the town that you're staying in looks so small because of perspective. It changes your perspective. And so God calls us to these mountaintops, okay? We spend time alone with Him. We get to the mountaintop with the Lord, and that's exactly what the mountain does. It changes our perspective. It changes our perspective of who He is. When we're spending time alone with Him, when we're getting to the mountain, when He's revealing a new attribute of Himself to us in some way, we get a new perspective of who He is, and in turn, we get a new perspective of who we are. Our identity is changed on the mountaintop. We begin to see who we are in a clear way, and so that's really what every chapter in the book seeks to do. It seeks to show us, God takes us to a mountain, and He shows us a change in who He is, and He shows us a change in who we are. And it's simply a change in perspective. And so that's the beauty of getting to the mountaintop. And I'd say this, Carmen, here's the thing. We're not supposed to live on the mountaintops, right? I mean, God speaks to us. He shows us Himself. He reveals Himself to us in new ways on the mountain. But we're never meant to live there. We always come back down to the regular valleys of life, and we're with people, and we're saying, hey, come go to the mountain with me, or we're telling people what we experienced there.
Which when you think about the rhythm of each one of these stories, that's precisely what happens. And so I deeply appreciate this approach. Again, friends, my conversation partner is Pastor Jarrett Stevens. You can find the book, The Mountains Are Calling, pretty much anywhere you go to get your books today. We have a couple of copies. So if you are saying to yourself, I need me some of that. Carmen's already said it's back to school. And for me, that's a back to the Bible or back to discipleship. This is a great opportunity for you to do that. So if this sounds like it's right up your alley, give us a call, 877-933-2484. You can also text that same number, 877-933-2484. Or, you can always email me, Carmen@myfaithradio.com. And those of you who let us know, we'll throw your names in a drawing and we'll send out as many copies of the book as we have. So, Jarrett, I want to invite you to take us to the last mountain, because that's one of the intriguing things about this book, is that there's a mountain in here to which none of us have yet been.
Yeah, it's great. Jesus, His ascension happened from a mountain. Acts chapter 1, verse 8, the disciples are standing there looking up into heaven after Jesus ascends, and these angels show up and says, hey, what are you looking at? The same Jesus that just ascended into heaven will return in the same way that you saw Him. And that last mountain is the one that Jesus promises to return to. And according to the prophet Zechariah chapter 14, when Jesus returns, and we believe in a literal physical return, He is going to step foot on the Mount of Olives. And again, I've had the opportunity to be in Israel a number of times, and it's an amazing thought to be there on that mountain where we know Jesus is going to return. And really what this mountain does is it serves as motivation. We know that Jesus is coming back. And so again, the motivation is to get down off the mountain and tell as many people we can about His love for them, how He died on a cross for them, He was raised to life, how He gives them hope and a future. And so that's what that chapter is all about.
So one of the things when you're standing there on the Mount of Olives, that perspective that you get across the across that shallow valley, it's not like being in the Rockies.
Right.
And so I think that for those of us who have had the privilege of going to Israel and being on the Mount of Olives, the proximity to the Temple Mount is pretty significant, and you're looking at the Eastern Wall, and it's such a take people there. Take people
it's
to the
amazing.
Mount of Olives since you've been there.
Yeah. Absolutely. It's amazing because, Carmen, you not only go, if you were to walk toward Jerusalem, toward the city, you have to walk down the Mount of Olives, and there's the Garden of Gethsemane. And, you know, there's a chapter in the book that I wasn't planning on writing because those listening to us today, you know, they're thinking mountaintop. My goodness, I hadn't been on a mountaintop with God in a long time. But valleys, I'll talk about valleys. And maybe they're in a dry time in their life or they're walking through just a season where God seems very distant. Well, you know, it's interesting as you walk down the Mount of Olives where Jesus ascended from and where he promises to return to, you go through the Garden of Gethsemane. It's right there at the base of the Mount of Olives. And as I was writing this book, I wanted to write to those who maybe did seem that God was a little bit distant. And those listening, if you asked them when God was closest to them, maybe they would talk about a mountaintop experience, but they talk about a desert experience. The Bible says God is near to the brokenhearted, and he saves those who are contrite in spirit. And so isn't it interesting that Jesus, the night that he was betrayed and ultimately abandoned by his disciples and put to death, he goes to the Garden of Gethsemane, and there he prays that prayer, Father, not my will, but your will be done. And then he ultimately goes to the cross. And I write about the Garden of Gethsemane because for so many downtimes in our life, for so many dry seasons, we all have our own Garden of Gethsemane. But isn't it interesting that God puts the Garden of Gethsemane on a mountain? You know, and when we look at those times in our life where we were broken and where God seemed the furthest, as we move past that and we look back at it, it's in the rearview mirror, you know, even those can be defined as mountaintop moments because God's presence was so near. And so it's just amazing, just the geography of Israel, because you go to the Mount of Olives, you go down the Garden of Gethsemane, and then you march through the Kidron Valley and right up to Mount Zion. And I love this verse. I put it in the front of the book. Psalm 125, 1 and 2 says, those who trust in the Lord are like Mount Zion, which cannot be moved, but abides forever. As the mountains surround Jerusalem, so the Lord surrounds his people from this time forth and forevermore. And so even the mountains, it's a beautiful picture of the faithfulness of God surrounding us.
Now, Jarrett, if people want to, because I'm betting that right now there's folks that are listening, they're saying, you know what, I'd like to listen to him preach. I'd like to hear what he has to say when he's teaching. Can they find that at prestonwood.org?
Absolutely. Prestonwood.org, and I share the pulpit here with Dr. Jack Graham, who is not only my pastor, but my spiritual father and hero. And so I'll preach every Saturday night, and some Sundays he preaches Sundays as well. So we share the pulpit here at Prestonwood.
Well, I love that. So, friends, you can go to prestonwood.org, and you can hear messages by Jarrett. You can also hear messages by Jack Graham. The book is The Mountains Are Calling, and you can find that anywhere books are sold. You can also, if you want to enter a drawing for the copies we have, you can either call or text me, 877-933-2484, 877-933-2484, or you can email me, Carmen@myfaithradio.com. Jarrett Stevens, thank you so much for joining us today on Connecting Faith.
Carmen, it's been a pleasure, and thank you so much for helping me get the word out about the book.
Absolutely. Well done, friend.
Thank you.
All right, friends, I got to take one more quick break. When we come back, I'll be making the connecting point. I'm Carmen LaBurge. You're listening to Connecting Faith. Hey, friends, you are listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge, and indeed, we do. We believe in God the Father. We believe in Jesus Christ. We believe in the Holy Spirit. And what we are seeking to do is bring the reality of heaven to bear here on earth. We're trying to reconnect the eternal with the everyday in ways that honor Jesus. And so thank you for joining me here today. This is the portion of the show where I like to make the connecting point, try to give you some interpretive keys to the news of the day. We've had a little breaking news while we have been on air. I want to share it with you. The governor of Arizona, Doug Ducey, is going to name retired Arizona Senator John Kyle to serve out the remainder of John McCain's Senate term. John Kyle was a dear friend of John McCain and served as a senator for the state of Arizona for many years. It's a great choice in this particular case. And interestingly, the thing that we're going to talk about here in the Connecting Point segment of the show today is the Senate confirmation hearing of Brett Kavanaugh. Well, John Kyle has actually been on the Hill with Brett Kavanaugh. He has been helping Brett Kavanaugh serving as what's called the Sherpa during all of his visits with all of the senators. So it's interesting, just an interesting day, I think, for John Kyle to have it be announced that he's going to be asked to fill the unexpired term of Senator John McCain. So Brett Kavanaugh, he is literally on what we call in our culture the hot seat. I don't know if you've ever been on a hot seat. Have you ever been on a hot seat? Have you ever had people who were supposed to be interviewing you? Like, these are his Senate confirmation hearings. This is the time in which senators on the Senate Judiciary Committee are supposed to be asking him questions. Well, thus far, so far, it's just speeches. So it's just speeches so far. So at some point, he's going to have the opportunity to make his opening statement, and then and then we'll see what happens. Apparently, it's gotten a little chaotic. So there might be those of you who are actually watching this on a live feed somewhere. And if you are, then you know that something has gone slightly awry. There must be something fairly chaotic going on, because Kavanaugh's young daughters have been removed from what is deemed an inappropriate environment for young people. That's disturbing. Okay, so let me talk about this political theater, because that is apparently what it has turned into. This is not what is supposed to be happening during a Senate confirmation hearing. Let me just say that right out. But it is what's happening. So today there's these opening statements. Again, I would just describe it as political theater. Those senators on the Senate Judiciary are, many of them, trying to make an appeal to the American public at large. They are trying to establish their view of constitutional interpretation instead of actually interviewing the candidate, the nominee, whom the president has nominated to serve in the vacancy on the Supreme Court. So tomorrow we'll have actual Q&A. That will also be a bit of political theater, I have no doubt. It's going to be, I think, 11 hours long is what it's scheduled for. Eventually, the committee will vote and make its recommendation to the full Senate, because the majority of the people on the Senate Judiciary Committee are Republicans. Even if it's a narrow vote, he will be recommended for confirmation by the committee to the full Senate. And because the GOP holds a very narrow margin in the Senate, he will, short of what the New York Times editorial board described as a direct meteor strike, he will be confirmed. He will be seated as the next justice of the Supreme Court, and he will be seated before the 1st of October, when the next session of the Supreme Court begins. Why spend this much time talking about this? Because when we talk about elections having consequences and elections mattering, this is one of those days when elections matter. It is the privilege of the sitting president to nominate his or her choice of justice for when there's a vacancy on the U.S. Supreme Court. And so President Donald Trump has now had the opportunity to nominate and have seated Justice Neil Gorsuch, and now the opportunity to nominate, and we would anticipate seat, Justice Brett Kavanaugh. Now Judge Brett Kavanaugh, but anticipating he will be Justice Brett Kavanaugh. The secular press is full of dire warnings. If you choose to read all of the dire warnings, you can. You could also listen to the interview that I did with Ken Starr on the 24th of August. You're going to hear references to Judge Kavanaugh's time of service with Ken Starr. And so interesting to hear Ken Starr's personal reflections on Brett Kavanaugh and how enthusiastic he is about this particular nomination. Ultimately, this Supreme Court nomination is going to come down to the same legal interpretive question that all of these decisions come down to now in this polarized time. So it's going to come down to whether or not you affirm or uphold an originalist or a textualist understanding of constitutional interpretation, which means that the Constitution says what it says, and it says what it says on purpose, and it means what it says. The words mean what they mean. The sentences mean what they mean. The grammar is there for a reason. The commas are not in the wrong place, like on and on and on. Like that the text of the Constitution actually matters, and that we're going to interpret the Constitution based on what it actually says, the actual words, the actual sentences, the actual paragraphs. Others would not view constitutional interpretation in that same way. They would have a more activist view of the judicial bench, and they would regard constitutional interpretation as the Constitution being a living document that is, it can always possibly mean something new depending on the current circumstances of any given day or time. And so there are new questions in the culture that could not have been anticipated by the framers of the Constitution, and therefore the justices need to find new rights or new ideas that would not have been intended by the framers of the Constitution, and therefore they create new law. They legislate from the bench, which is, if you know the concept of the three branches of government, then you know that that's not where new laws are supposed to be made. So Judge Kavanaugh has been, and he is an originalist. He is a textualist, maybe would be one way of understanding that. And that's what you're going to hear him pressed about by those who do not have that view of constitutional interpretation. Judge Kavanaugh has also been an ardent defender of religious liberty. So I expect a number of lines of questioning pitting people of sincere religious faith against LGBTQ advocates, abortion advocates, and those who want to see the separation of church and state interpreted to mean that no Christian should have any influence in the public square. So I expect those to be some lines of questioning that we see emerge. For those of you who don't know me historically, I spent a fairly long period of my time engaged in mainline Protestant renewal efforts in the Presbyterian Church USA. So I can actually tell you from my own experience that what we are experiencing here in this Supreme Court nomination process is reflective of the kinds of efforts that progressives have been utilizing in mainline Christianity now for more than a generation. This is where church influences state in ways that most folks don't see, or, you know, these are dots most people do not connect. As goes the mainline, so goes the culture. That's the way I would put it succinctly. Mainline progressives who were unable to get the legislative bodies of their respective churches to move on the subject of, at that point, lesbian and gay ministers, they sought the change in the systems through judicial action. And so eventually you got legislative change in the Episcopal Church and in the Presbyterian Church USA. But initially in both of those institutions, the first leg to crack off the bench was the judicial leg. And pretty much once you saw off the judicial leg, it doesn't take long for the legislative leg to fall as well. The other leg, by the way, for those denominations would be accountability or church discipline. And if you have no standards left to hold anybody accountable to, it's silly to have a stool with one leg. So I bring this up today to highlight the process by which progressives in America have sought to influence not only the federal judiciary and the Supreme Court to get what they want, but to highlight the fact that we have experienced, if we're paying attention, we have experienced this kind of process in other environments, in other institutions, in our culture. And so I'm encouraging you to connect some of those dots today. If you have some experience in any branch of mainline Christianity, you probably know what I'm pointing to. You probably have seen the discipline in your own church not rightly applied by whatever the quote-unquote court, ecclesiastical court, is. And so the founders envisioned three co-equal but separate branches of government. The role of the judiciary is not the same as the role of the legislative branch. And that's where we have to remember, that it takes some gymnastics if you're going to force the Constitution to mean something that it does not mean. So the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings are going to come down to that question. Kavanaugh is a strict originalist or textualist. He takes and interprets the Constitution at its words, in its context, and even, you know, with the understanding that the grammar itself is intentional. All right, friends, let's uphold him in prayer today as he is in the hot seat all week. Let's uphold his family and his kids. You have been listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. Visit us online at myfaithradio.com. Have a great day, and God bless. Thanks for listening to this conversation from Connecting Faith. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend to grow the impact of Connecting Faith. Also, take a moment to subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player and never miss a conversation.